From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the Western UP tries to change up its public health approach for a changing COVID population.
Now we're actually seeing that move out into more of the workforce age population. So our numbers are showing, you know, that 25 to 40, 50 year old is more apt to be infected now.
Also, voters rise up by the hundreds to support certification of Detroit's election.
It was disappointment. It was anguish. It was just amazing, the energy that you felt come from the public.
Crisis averted. Now it's on to the state level. Plus, we'll meet a doctor who spent days with his patients at their jobs as migrant workers.
One day, I happened upon a farmer, and he was very interested in my project. And he said, "You can come here as much as you want."
A world not often seen captured in dramatic photos. Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, the epic explosion at the otherwise bureaucratic and boring Wayne County Board of Canvassers meeting.
I know oftentimes we talk about this is what democracy looked like. Last night was the best picture ever.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, Michigan continues to record new COVID cases, and the state could very well set a new record for COVID hospitalizations sometime later this week. In the Upper Peninsula, caseloads are rising at alarming rates, which some hospitals and health departments say they don't have enough resources to handle. We wanted to check back in with Catherine Beer. She's health officer for the Western UP Health Department, which serves Baraga, Gogebic, Houghton, Keweenaw, and Ontonagon counties. Kate, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on again.
Since last time we spoke, COVID cases have been rising significantly. What kind of increase has your team been seeing in your region?
We've seen quite an explosion of cases in our region. So the five counties that we serve, you know, at the beginning of this, we would, you know, see small outbreaks in individual counties. But now we are seeing substantial increases in all five counties at the same time. So our workload has increased dramatically.
Have you been able to trace these to particular kinds of gatherings or events?
There's been just a few that we've been able to really pinpoint where they're coming from. Majority has been either small gatherings or, you know, weddings, funerals, that kind of thing. But right now we have several nursing homes that have significant outbreaks.
Who's getting sick? I can infer what's going on in some of the nursing homes, but outside of that kind of care, who do you see getting the illness?
So what we had seen was it had started out, you know, with the elderly population, and that continued when we saw the long-term care population become infected. But now we're actually seeing that move out into more of the workforce age population. So our numbers are showing, you know, that 25 to 40, 50 year old is more apt to be infected now.
Can you tell if there's any pattern to what age group is dealing with hospitalizations?
Not yet. For us, it really, the elderly do have the lion's share, I guess, of hospitalizations, but we've had several recently that are pretty concerning with that middle age group.
Let's talk a little bit about testing in your area. There was a recent notice from the Western UP Health Department that announced capacity had been reached and that the department might not be able to contact every person who tested positive or their close connections who might have been exposed. What does that mean to reach capacity? And in that situation, how do you prioritize who you're going to try to call?
So reaching capacity, you know, has been, you know, something that we've struggled with here for a while before making our announcement. We've actually hired additional staff. And like I said, with the increase that we've seen in all counties at once, we're just pretty overwhelmed with the number of cases that are coming through. So what we're looking at is, you know, making sure that we reach the most vulnerable of the population. So the people that are in the 65 and older age group, and then moving on to the school-aged children so that we can keep kids in school by, you know, removing those that are positives or close contacts within those school buildings quickly. And, you know, then we will try to get who we can get to after that. The goal, of course, is to try to reach everybody. But, you know, there's a lag between when somebody becomes ill, when they can get tested, and when that test result comes back. So oftentimes, by the time we can get to that case, they may already be out of isolation.
Mm. In terms of hospitals, it looks like as of yesterday afternoon, the UP Health System Portage Hospital in Hancock, that's Houghton County, is at 82% bed occupancy. What level of resources do the hospitals in the Western UP have right now? And what exactly are healthcare workers that you know dealing with?
So right now, what we're seeing is really an increase in emergency room visits. So emergency departments are seeing increased activity for the hospitals in our area. As far as the hospital bed capacity, they are still serving people for, you know, regular daily occurrences for acute care, and they're also seeing people for elective surgeries. So part of their planning would be to, you know, if there is a surge, they would reduce those elective surgeries and then reserve those beds then for COVID patients.
And sounds like that's happening.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're averaging, you know, in this district, you know, each of our hospitals has probably between 3 and 7 or more COVID-related patients. And then some of those patients are transferred out to larger facilities, either in Wisconsin or elsewhere in the UP, even as far as Duluth.
How far are we from a point at which getting rid of elective surgery and sending folks elsewhere just isn't quite enough to meet the cases in the area?
Yeah, we're not to that point yet, but you know, the issue is it could happen overnight. So what we're seeing is each week our cases are continually growing. So before, when we would see, you know, 30 or 40 cases per week, we're now seeing 30 or 40 cases per day. So as this moves forward, that switch as far as being able to accommodate all COVID patients could happen rather quickly. And that would be the point that we would be really concerned. You know, there's not only the limitation on the hospital beds available, but there's the limitation of staff in our area.
You know, so many of the medical professionals that we've talked to have said that they're learning about the disease. There are even some hospitals in Michigan that are recording fewer deaths, even as the case rates have gone through the ceiling. What about in the Western UP? Are you seeing fewer deaths compared with earlier surges in the year?
You know, I think it's a little bit too early for us to tell. And our case rates are skewed a little bit because we have such an elderly population. But I do know that some of the pharmaceuticals that have been brought online are being used in our local area. And I do believe that they've helped people with being able to leave the hospital rather than become a case of fatality statistic.
Part of the Western UP region shares a border with Wisconsin in an area that the Wisconsin Department of Health Services rates as experiencing critically high COVID case activity right now. You're in this situation in both Michigan and Wisconsin worlds. How does the case rate across the border in Wisconsin affect what you and your department are dealing with?
So particularly in our Gogebic County, we've seen this throughout the COVID pandemic where, you know, things that happen in Wisconsin affect our Michigan residents and vice versa. Especially, you know, when we look at our hospital or our healthcare down in Gogebic County, many of the staff are shared between each state. So there's always that transmission of virus or issues back and forth. So it does impact us greatly, being that their rules might be different than ours. So we have to deal with that. We have to just move forward and do the best that we can down there.
Yeah. What are the substantial differences between Michigan and Wisconsin's approach to the pandemic?
Yeah. So we found this throughout the whole pandemic here is that, you know, our bordering counties have had significant issues with the fact that, you know, Wisconsin, their bars and restaurants have been open. And a lot of our people, particularly in the summer, a lot of our younger people would just cross the border. So, you know, we've been working with that the whole time. You know, they just handle things a little bit differently than we do. So it's a constant communication process with our counterparts over in Wisconsin. We've actually worked very closely with them because a lot of times we're handing cases back and forth.
Yeah. The issue of taking personal responsibility to fight COVID-19 has been coming up a lot in public health circles and politics circles as well. Some of our state's lawmakers have suggested that stopping the virus has to come from folks' individual sense of responsibility. How effective are you finding that right now?
So, you know, in our area particularly, you know, we're fighting with the enforcement part of it because, you know, people have free will, like we've talked about before. And, you know, it's difficult. And I think that was one of our calls to action when we issued our press release saying that we were prioritizing cases. Because, you know, we are at that point where we can't manage it all. We can't, you know, be responsible for everybody's actions in this instance. So, you know, we are calling on people to do the next best thing or the next right thing and, you know, limit those gatherings. If you are positive or you suspect that you're positive, you know, begin your isolation right away. Call your close contacts. You know, this is really going to take a community effort to stop this tide as we move forward here now. We're just not able to hold that line anymore.
Does it bother you that the state's not taking further action right now?
You know, I don't know that they can right now. There's a lot of pushback even in our area regarding the new rules and regulations. So, you know, what bothers me more is that a public health pandemic has turned into more of a political debate than it should have been.
Is there anybody that you could tell us about who you know personally who's gotten sick?
Actually, there's a few people that I've been acquaintance with over the last few years, or actually through my lifetime, that one has died and one is in the hospital right now in dire condition. And these are people who are under the age of 60.
Kate, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Kate Beer is health officer for the Western UP Health Department. Kate, take care and good luck.
Thank you for having me on again today.
Coming up, a doctor and occasional photographer introduces us to some of his former patients.
It's really sad that many Americans are missing out on the heroic and tragic stories that are going on right around us. And I think they're quite remarkable people.
Stories and photos of Michigan's migrant workers. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As Thanksgiving Day approaches, you know that there's going to be apple pie on the dinner table. But when was the last time you stopped to think about the hands that harvest those apples? Dr. Eric Bowens is a physician and sometime photographer who wanted to capture the lives of migrant workers that he knew from his medical practice out in the fields doing their work to earn a living. He's recently published some of these photos online, and he joins us now to talk more about it. Dr. Bowens, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Can I just ask, for starters, what photography has meant to you during this time when sometimes it's just difficult to connect with people?
Well, I've had an interest in photography for some time, but like many of us, I've had to shut down certain portions of it, like doing something in a studio or photographing dancers in a dance studio. So I decided, what can I do outside that doesn't put me at excessive risk? That made me recall that I have some unfinished business with having worked with migrant workers. And I re-examined and remembered my desire to share some from their lives.
You have worked in the past as a physician with the Migrant Health Service. Could you talk to us a little bit about the people you met during that time?
Yes. When I first moved to Michigan, I joined the Migrant Health Service in Sparta, Michigan. So I was one of the two local physicians there for several years and taking care of both local townspeople, year-round townspeople, but also the migrant workers who are very heavily involved in the fruit harvest in the what's called the Fruit Ridge. That's somewhat north and west of Grand Rapids.
And the folks you met there, were they sometimes the same folks coming back season after season?
Yeah, most people would come back season after season. There's a certain time frame that they would come to Michigan, then they go to North Carolina, then they go to Florida. So there's a circuit that people are on. Of course, over time, some people begin to settle out of the migrant stream and develop more permanent homes in the area.
Right. How did you go about this project? I mean, it's one thing to have had inroads in those communities when you were working in them as a physician, but it's another thing to find folks in the midst of what is a pretty action-packed season. I mean, I think a lot of people may not appreciate just how hard and how fast migrant laborers have to work when they're harvesting in the fields. How did you get the access?
I initially had mostly failure. I would ride around or drive around the migrant areas, the apple harvesting, and see signs for no trespassing and get some dirty looks and even threatened once walking down the street with my camera. So I was quite discouraged, to tell you the truth. And then one day I happened upon a farmer who was, looked very friendly. He was on a tractor. And I just said hello. And surprisingly, he was very interested in my project. And he said, you can come here as much as you want. You can go anywhere on the farm. You have unlimited access.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about how much time you were able to spend with these folks and sort of where they were when you captured them.
Yes, I initially photographed them in the apple orchards harvesting. But as you mentioned, they're working very, very fast. And I didn't want to interrupt them. So I couldn't really engage them in much conversation. It was somewhat superficial photos of them harvesting. But then I learned when is a good time to hang out in the migrant camp where they live, and gradually was able to develop relationships with many of them. And they became used to me hanging around. So we had conversations.
Can you tell me a little bit about who some of these folks were and where they were from?
Most of them are originally from Mexico and now live in the U.S. all the time because crossing back and forth on the border is really impossible right now. And it was quite interesting because the project that I had canceled of traveling to the state of Oaxaca, Mexico, is actually where many of these people are from. So I actually sort of traveled there by talking with these folks. So I knew the towns that they were from, both in Oaxaca, Mexico, but also in Guatemala, where I'd also done some volunteer work before. So it allowed me to make a connection fairly quickly.
We can see from the photos, you know, it's a good reminder that when folks come for these jobs, they bring their whole families with them. And you photograph them, you know, fooling around with their kids and holding babies and things of that nature.
Yes.
Was it hard to find the time when they were being themselves and just sort of stepping away from the work for a moment?
Well, it took a little bit of time, but I learned that the work life is about 12 hours a day. But sometimes on Saturday or Sunday, it ends a little early. People get paid, they have to go to town, do washing, so on and so forth. And then sometimes work is shut down a little bit in the morning if there's a frost and they can't harvest the apples until it gets above a certain temperature. So I took advantage of those two times.
Yeah. Tell me, what did you make of the living conditions you found them in?
I thought that they were very basic, not horrible. Most of they were old trailers, travel trailers or vacation trailers, and often did not have heating. So oftentimes the stove would be the source of heat.
Not to downplay the difficulty of the work that these folks do, but at the same time, you were able to capture the joy in their faces and in their lives. There were some families and children that you got to know through this process, and you were able to share interviews with some of the folks that you photographed. There's one woman, I'd like to play a little bit of what she said. We won't say her name. She's originally from Oaxaca and has been here for 17 years.
Cuando yo llegué era en el mes de diciembre, hacía mucho frío.
When I first arrived, it was December. It was very cold. We didn't have any money or know anyone. I remember we were staying in a trailer. We only had one little blanket between the four of us and no heater. And we didn't have the money yet to buy more blankets. When we first arrived, we suffered very much.
Are there things that you wish people understood better about the lives of the folks that you photographed?
I wish that they understood how much they have in common in terms of their desires for life, that they want to provide for their children, their families. They want food. They're not bad people. They are sometimes heroic. And I think it's really sad that many Americans are missing out on the heroic and tragic stories. They're going on right around us. And I think they're quite remarkable people.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about how COVID and the pandemic has impacted the people who are working in our fields?
Well, interestingly, I did not find any evidence that anybody had had COVID who are working as migrant workers. I didn't do an extensive survey, but my suspicion is that the outdoor work contributes to less risk, and also that people are just living in individual trailers, that it's individual family, so there's not a mixed multifamily home. So I actually think that they're better off than immigrants and Hispanics living in Grand Rapids, where there's a very high rate.
That's good to hear. I know that this has been a very tough year in some of the food processing plants where other migrant workers find jobs. Dr. Bowens, I have to ask, I mean, COVID is really ravaging the state's communities right now. And you're in West Michigan. We know that this has caused a lot of hardship in hospitals and among clinics and providers. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing right now?
Sure. I was actually working in a COVID clinic earlier in March and April when it first hit, but now I'm back in my regular office, and I am seeing healthcare workers come in who are in distress from the stress of working on the COVID units. Particularly, I saw one nurse last week who had pretty severe anxiety and depression related to those stresses. So I think this is pretty widespread, that people are really experiencing distress, worry for themselves, for their families. And because they're having to work perhaps long hours, they're very stressed with the situations that they face.
Folks may not be aware of what that kind of stress means. I mean, what kind of conditions are they facing in the workplace that give them this level of anxiety? Is it because the people that they're dealing with are so sick?
I think that's one part of it. And also it is the crush of patients. That is, perhaps they would normally admit a few patients per day. Things are go in an orderly manner. But now people are piled up in the hallways, can't get beds yet. There's not a place to put them. So people are being stressed to do more with less. That's a great stress. The other thing is that some, especially in the nursing and other areas, are being asked to work 16-hour shifts. So just not getting any time to rest or recover.
It's really hard to see what the immediate solution to this is going to be, given that there are so many communities in Michigan that can't spare people right now. Do you have any thoughts on what might get healthcare workers through this?
Well, I think we all have to work together and respect, be aware of when one or two people are struggling or at their end of their emotional rope. We have to watch out for each other. We have to, at some point, there may have to be some decisions made about who gets care. There will not be enough people to take care of them. And some care will be rationed.
Will you tell us a little bit about where we can see your photographs for those who may be hearing this and want to see your work?
Sure. Well, I have some pretty good collection posted on my website, which is www.ericbowensphotography, all one word, .com. You're welcome to come and take a look. Unfortunately, in COVID times, we can't display work in a gallery or a museum. So that's what I've got right now.
Dr. Eric Bowen's coming to us from Grand Rapids. Thank you so much for your work and your photographs. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The small town of Idlewild was once called the Black Eden of Michigan. For decades, it attracted thousands of Black musicians and entrepreneurs and families every weekend. That didn't last, as many left Idlewild behind. Those who stayed, like Dilla Scott, who lived briefly there in the 90s, didn't feel safe.
Idlewild means the men are idle and the women are wild. You could go right around the corner and there are those people who are disruptive to their own community, to themselves and to others.
But a lot has changed in Idlewild in the past few years. Now, Black residents and entrepreneurs are leading the community's rebirth. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has the story.
In many ways, Idlewild is like a lot of places in northern Michigan. It's beautiful, with long winding roads curving around lakes on each side of town. In the summer, there's constant traffic of trucks dragging boats and RVs to and from. Then there are the differences. Idlewild, which is about 90 minutes south of Traverse City, has historical markers celebrating Black artists and entrepreneurs. There's a street named after W.E.B. Du Bois. Ron Stevens teaches African American studies at Purdue University. He's building a home in Idlewild. He says the rural town wasn't always the quiet place it is now.
There was a clubhouse here. It was a hotel over there. There was a nightclub where those cars are in the corner there. This roadway was not even here. It was a footbridge. Totally different.
In the 1950s, 25,000 people would come to Idlewild any given weekend.
You know, it was a space where you did not have to worry about any forms of discrimination. You came to celebrate. You came to relax. You came to have fun.
But that didn't last. Stevens says the passage of civil rights legislation and more economic opportunities for Black people meant they could vacation somewhere else. Over decades, much of Idlewild's population left, dwindling it down to a few hundred people at the turn of the century. But around 2012, a number of hotels and businesses were designated as historical sites by the state, including the old Paradise Club. The club once held concerts featuring performers like Jackie Wilson, The Four Tops, and Etta James. Joe Lindsay's family now owns the lot where the Paradise Club stood. He moved to Idlewild in 1965.
So if a person really want to have a nice time, clean, fun, this was a place to be. People was coming from all over the state of Michigan just to enjoy night shows and so forth.
The club is gone. The lot is now run by Joe's son, Eric, who was raised in Idlewild. His family turned it into a campsite for tents and RVs where they hold events. For example, the Idlewild International Film Festival was scheduled for August. And Eric Lindsay says until COVID shut everything down, there was huge demand.
Every weekend from June, from the beginning of June through the after Labor Day, was booked with events. So we definitely saw our calendars grow of events here, and hopefully next year we can get back on track.
Eric says the comfort Idlewild offers Black people is more important than ever in the wake of national protests over racial injustice.
The place I can come and breathe, breathe good, clean, fresh air, and using that word breathe right now, and it's so political right now, but I am able to breathe here. And another thing, I feel safe. It's a place where I feel safe.
Blair Evans says that comfort is important to Black entrepreneurs who see opportunity in Idlewild. He's on the Township Planning Commission.
There's a different feel. Even though you know how to navigate that terrain, you know how to code switch, you know how to do whatever, it feels a lot different if you're on home ground in a culture that envelops you, as opposed to, again, kind of tiptoeing around in eggshells in some other context.
Evans also co-owns the now historic Morton's Motel, which was in Victor Hugo Green's Green Book, a guide for Black drivers to find safe lodging. Evans bought the motel just to preserve it, but says pre-COVID, he was getting enough visitors to make it a viable business.
Idlewild, you know, was a lot of empty space, it kind of seemed like 10 years ago. Now it's like we don't have enough room to do the stuff that that folks are really kind of angling for.
A study done by MSU Extension in 2013 showed Idlewild's housing prices and population have steadily ticked up, while those unemployed or on government assistance have gone down. Evans says Idlewild's next big hurdle is having the infrastructure for long-term growth, things like better internet access and road maintenance.
This year, a lot of people are kind of calling up saying, okay, you know, we're doing remote work. I'd like to do it up there. Is the infrastructure from a digital perspective here to do that, et cetera? So there are different areas of economic opportunity that are really emerging here.
Ron Stevens's home in Idlewild is still under construction. It should be done in the next 2 to 3 years. He says Idlewild, like a lot of places in northern Michigan, is still figuring out its identity. Is it a resort town, a year-round destination, a retirement community, or all the above? Stevens doesn't know the answer yet, but he does know one thing. He's excited to retire here.
And I can imagine myself sitting around a campfire on my property with my grandkids telling them stories, right? And so it's happiness, it's peace, it's serenity.
In Traverse City, I'm Max Johnston.
Up next, an insurgent effort to undermine Wayne County's election results goes completely sideways.
People run for offices and you lose. You eat your Haagen-Dazs, you cry, you do whatever you have to do to release the anguish. But what you don't do is you don't attack the process. You don't attack the people for letting their will and wishes be known.
That's next. Stay with us on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last night's public meeting of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers exploded into an arena for the conflicting pressures of the 2020 election. One of the board's jobs is to certify election results from city and township clerks. And two Republican members of the board, Monica Palmer and Will Hartman, said last night that they were unwilling to do that. As the word spread over social media, the Zoom meeting's already packed waiting room became jammed, and 3 hours of public comment followed. People like the Reverend Wendell Anthony, pastor at Detroit's Fellowship Church and head of the Detroit chapter of the NAACP, were not having it.
You look at black cities, you have extracted a black city out of a county and said the only ones that are at fault at an issue is the city of Detroit, where 80% of the people who reside here are African Americans. Shame on you. Shame on you for leading to this level of corruption. You have disavowed your right to even sit in the seat that you occupy. You are a disgrace as relates to the ability to have a free and impartial election in this nation.
Ultimately, the two dissenting members of the board reversed course. But it was a sign of how little Trump supporters are interested in backing off unsupported claims of voter fraud and how short patience is running among Democratic voters. Jonathan Kinlock is a member of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers. He's also the political director of SEIU Healthcare of Michigan. Jonathan, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
When did you realize that the two Republicans on the board, Monica Palmer and Will Hartman, that they were not in favor of certification?
At the moment of their vote, because all last week, the two canvassers were basically saying that, you know, that they would certify unless there was anything extraordinary that came from the canvas. And so I believe it was like Friday, Saturday is when the tone started to change they began to talk about having to balance to zero, but we got to get them as close to zero. And so then I started to get concerned, and the possibility that they would vote no started coming to mind.
How would you describe the mood in the Zoom room when they announced?
Oh, it was disappointment. It was anguish. It was just amazing the energy that you felt come from the public. And once they began to have an opportunity to speak and address the board, it was just as if history lessons were being retold and explained, and the impact of that board, our board's decision on what it meant to history, what it meant to us as Black people, as what it meant to us as an entire community and county, the disenfranchisement, what that meant historically and what that meant today. So it was just a broad picture that so many people brought through their voices and participating in that meeting yesterday. It was amazing. I know oftentimes we talk about this is what democracy looked like. Last night was the best picture ever.
3 hours of dissenting comments.
Yes, you had Canton, you had, listen, because people need to understand all, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, across this country, in the state of Michigan, in County Wayne, these clerks, these individuals who are responsible for administering election, they take their job seriously. And then to have someone just so whimsically just throw off the work that they have put into translating the will of the people, it's just outrageous that people would just take it so lightly and to make these charges that have come from Republicans because their candidate lost. Look, I've run for office, I've lost. People run for offices and you lose. You eat your Haagen-Dazs, you cry, you do whatever you have to do to release the anguish. But what you don't do is you don't attack the process. You don't attack the people for letting their will and wishes be known.
You were there. What do you think it was that changed Will Hartman and Monica Palmer's minds? They ultimately did relent and say that they were comfortable with certification. What changed?
Listen, you know, I've been involved in Democratic Party politics since I was a teenager, and I understand the sense of camaraderie and the team approach. But sometimes when you go into these public positions, you may get there by being associated with a party, but you have to be there on behalf of the people. I have to take my hat off to them because they were under a lot of pressure. I believe the public comments, I believe the conversation between us as we were continuing to try to work through this, I believe they wanted to find a solution to bring about the certification of this election. And that solution was to demand that the Secretary of State, Johnson Benson, conduct an audit upon the completion of the certification process. And that allowed for them to do this. And I think that that was a good compromise. And so I think that had a lot to do with getting them to feel comfortable enough to move on their previous decision.
Right. Jonathan, as you noted, quite a few of the commenters stated that they saw a refusal to certify as an undeniable effort to disenfranchise Detroit's Black voters. Monica Palmer said at one point that she would be okay with certifying every place but Detroit. I had a friend from out of town who was watching all this play out over social media, and she asked me, is this maybe the answer to institutional change, is to have people who don't agree step up and name racism when they see it in play and remind people of their place in history? What do you think of that?
I thought many of those messages were on point. None of that was choreographed. People spoke from the heart. And I think that is always the most effective way to communicate when you're trying to make the people's will known, for the people themselves to come step forward and to speak organically and from the heart. But we have to remind people who have not walked through history and having to deal with the ills and the pains that the Black community and the Brown community and, you know, all the other nationalities that have come into this country and have been met with resistance, you know. And so all I'm saying is that sometimes we need to remind people that it's easy for you to not understand the impact of your decision, but the impact of your decision has a face on it, and here are the faces. And I think that for Michigan and for where we are, we're walking through history and living history as we're making it. And oftentimes we don't realize that. And I think we will find great things written on the pages in the future as it relates to how we handled this moment in time.
This deadlock was the result of two Republicans on the board of canvassers disagreeing with two Democrats on the board of canvassers. Do you think that this four-person structure with two members of the major parties is still the right structure to represent the county?
I do. It forces a decision in a matter of this importance. But you need to understand the discretion of certification has already been removed from us, taken away from us in law. Our functions as ministerial, our job is to execute the certification. The action, had it stood, would have been followed up with lawsuits, would have been followed up with actions to actually call for their removal for not conducting the performance of their duties. So when you take on these responsibilities under the Michigan election law, they come with serious consequences if you don't carry them out.
Jonathan Kinlock is a member of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers. His day job is with SEIU Healthcare Michigan. Jonathan, always a pleasure. We now turn to Chris Thomas, the former longtime state elections director who worked with Detroit this election cycle to shore up its voting system. Chris, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
What happened last night at the Wayne County Board of Canvassers? To your knowledge, has anything like that ever happened before in modern Michigan history?
Well, I've never seen anything quite like that, that's for certain. It was quite a spectacle. I think it renews one's competence in public comment section of meetings. I don't know that I've ever seen a reversal like that based on impassioned comments made by those who stuck it out and stayed with it through several hours.
What was your reaction when you realized what was happening, that these two members of the board were intended not to certify the results?
Yeah, I was disappointed to see that. I think as a counsel to the board told them, they really don't have that opportunity under the law. An unbalanced precinct is not the basis to fail to certify. The law is set up so that if, in fact, a county were to have problems and couldn't certify, then it would move to the Board of State Canvassers. So it's already anticipated that no county could withhold their certifications, or if counties had some sort of difficulty in making the deadline, that there would be a remedy.
The two members relented, we hear, in part because Secretary of State Benson agreed to undertake an inquiry into their concerns. You were at the TCF Center during Detroit's vote count, providing assistance to the city clerk. Could you just tell us what you have to say about the actual concerns that the two members brought up, that some of the people who were checked in to vote did not match who was actually voted?
What I understand is that countywide, there are basically a minus roughly 475, which means there are 475 names without ballots attached to them. That was countywide. There's close to 30, maybe more than 30 jurisdictions in Wayne County that did not balance every single precinct. And I think you'll find that across the state. We had a huge turnout, unprecedented turnout, and most of that by mail, which no question swamped many election officials. And it was through their good efforts that they dealt and were prepared to deal with it. But there's going to be a few glitches along the way. There's nothing untoward with these unbalances. A lot of people shorthand that and say, well, if it's unbalanced here, then it's unrecountable. That's not necessarily true. You will not know that until that ballot can is opened in a recount and a number of ballots are counted to see if that's the number of ballots that went through the computer on election day. And if that's the case, then it's recountable, regardless of how many names are in the book or not in the book. So it is certainly, out of 900,000 votes cast, looking at 474 votes, is not something that people should be highly concerned about.
Secretary of State Benson seemed pretty unflappable last night. She said she was calm about the process and that it would play out according to law. Did you feel that same sense of calm?
I did. I shared that calm because I know it's going to the Board of State Canvassers before they reverse themselves. And the Board of State Canvassers could come in and complete the canvass. Our position at the city clerk's office was fine if you're going to come in and do that. We've been working with the county since Election Day, and we'll continue working with the Secretary of State and the Board of State canvassers. Our interest was in getting a good canvass. So, yes, I really was not disturbed in terms of the final certification. The Board of State canvassers have no authority to deadlock and not do the job they're required to do. And I fully would have expected them to certify the election, because let's look at it. This is not just an election for president. So if they would have failed to certify the entire election for every single office on the ballot that goes down to the, you know, all the way down to the local level. So that was certainly never going to happen.
The Board of State canvassers canceled its meeting for today since all the counties went ahead and certified, and they are scheduled to meet on the 23rd to do their state certification work. Do you have any concerns about politics entering that state certification in a similar way?
I would hope not. They have no investigatory authority. That all comes during recounts if they are requested. The canvass is basically counting votes to compile the canvasses of the 83 counties and come up with a statewide official certification of the total number of votes that all statewide candidates and legislative districts that cross county lines received, and to make those official.
A lot of folks have wondered aloud about whether the state legislature might step in and appoint its own electors if somehow the state board did fail to certify. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey has thrown cold water on that idea, but do you know if legally that's even possible, or would it have to go to the courts?
Well, I think there's a step there before the legislature would even be involved. There would be a mandamus case filed immediately, which is basically a cause of action that tells a government board, do your job. And it would ultimately end up in the courts, ultimately at the Michigan Supreme Court, directing the board to do what they're required to do by law. I can't imagine that the board would do that. And it's basically pretty humiliating when you take a position not to do your job and have to have a court tell you to get to work.
This has been a poster year for concerns over election security. We do have our results now. At the end of the day, how do you think it played out?
I think the security played out very well. Chris Krebs at Homeland Security is in the news now as having been fired by President Trump, did a courageous thing. He and a number of election officials around the country issued a report earlier this week saying that the elections across the United States were more secure than in any time in the past. The amount of work that's been done on cybersecurity of our elections since 2016 is literally amazing. So I think the voters should rest assured that Mr. Krebs and election officials across this country have stepped up and done what they're required to do. And it's very unfortunate that he was fired for doing a job that he was hired to do and doing it well.
Chris Thomas is a former director of elections for the state of Michigan. Chris, thank you very much.
I was happy to do it. Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. It's good to have you here. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.